Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome renowned astronomer Bob Berman back to the studio to field all of your astronomy-related questions. Bob is he is a wonder. He'll make the difficult things to understand relatively simple, even so much so that a broadcaster can figure it out. Give us a call now, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website. It's wamc.org/voxpop, or you can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You could tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, or you could email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Of course, it's really not much of a call-in show unless people call, so you might as well give us a call as well. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Bob, welcome back.
Thanks, Gray. So, great to be here.
So you have... You probably won't be back before the next big meteor shower, and you're excited about this one.
Right. Usually I come once a month from now. Yeah, I think we're going to just barely miss it. But this is exciting because August 11th is the reliable summer Perseid meteor shower. Fabulous from any place away from city lights. And this year is going to be exceptional. And the moon, which is the big X factor, because when the moon is bright, it really diminishes the number of shooting stars that are seen. And this year, the moon's going to be a harmless little thin crescent that sets just a few hours after sunset, so that by 11 o'clock midnight, which is when they really start getting going, the moon will be absent, perfect conditions.
Ooh, that's exciting. So get away from city lights, and the moon will not be wreaking havoc on your view. That's great. Now, when we started the show, I teased this thing you and I were discussing, and that is a new thinking about gravity and perhaps nixing out the possibility of dark matter. Explain this.
Right. The two big unknowns in the universe are dark matter and dark energy. Dark energy being the more mysterious of the two, but dark matter is mysterious too. Ever since Fritz Zwicky back in 1930 noticed that the cluster of galaxies that we live in, the local group, have motion. Each galaxy has a certain amount of movement, and the movement is so fast that each galaxy should be able to easily escape from the gravitational clutches of the collective, of the Borg collective. They should be able to be out of here and not be a cluster of galaxies long ago, but we're still a cluster. Then later on, it was found that the way our galaxy spins is strange. Both of those point to the existence of about six times more stuff, gravity, than can be explained by everything we can possibly see. So we think that dark matter, some exotic perhaps material that has gravity but doesn't give off light, is responsible. Now, the newest idea is that we don't need dark matter if gravity itself behaves differently from what Newton said and Einstein believed, and that instead of getting weaker and weaker with distance, inversely with the square of distance, which means something that moves three times farther away, the galaxy will be three times three, or nine times weaker. Instead of falling off like that, that it does happen like that in close-up situations, because obviously we have a good handle on gravity in our own neighborhood. Mm. But what about when you get to really big distances, galactic distances, distances between stars? If gravity behaves differently than we thought, and it falls off differently, then there's no need for dark matter. It also changes everything so far as the age of the universe, the Big Bang. And these particular scientists show that the way our Milky Way has two companion galaxies and Andromeda has companion galaxies, all of those could have been formed if Andromeda and the Milky Way had a brush with each other 10 billion years ago, if gravity is different from the way we think, so that instead of merging into one colossal super galaxy, which is what will happen in the future, didn't happen, even though if galaxies behave the way we think they are, it should have merged, but they didn't because gravity is different from the way we think. And they can show mathematically that all of that makes perfect sense if these ideas are true. Gravity is different and no dark matter. So this would be a big change in our thinking. It would affect everything.
Okay.
We'd have to go back to the drawing board on the entire universe.
All right. Now, you have railed against, and rightfully so, many times, things like string theory and things that are not provable at this time. What have they done experimentally to point to this?
Right. And you said it accurately, you said to point to this. So I've not bought this yet. I'm just open-minded about it, because what they've done is shown that mathematically, the odd way that we have these companion galaxies, and Andromeda has these two companion galaxies, NGC 205 and M32, they would be there just as they are if this scenario happened, if a near brush between us happened in the past.
Just between Andromeda and the Milky Way.
You see, the other thing is Andromeda is coming toward us. This is an odd thing. The universe is almost entirely galaxies expanding away from each other, but Andromeda is coming toward us at 70 miles closer every second. And this too would be part of the scenario if we've had brushes in the past, that we're not just destined to collide between 3 and 5 billion years from now, which is what everyone believes, but we've done it in the past. And this is a minuet, a waltz that we have played perhaps over and over again.
But eventually it'll lead to a collision, right?
Eventually it'll lead to a collision. But if the gravity is different from the way we think, then there was a past collision, and it would have produced just what we see and solved some of the mysteries of the lesser galaxies that are around us in space. So there's some evidence for this, but, you know, great claims require great proof.
Yeah.
And so
we shall see.
We'll see.
1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Bob Berman is our guest. Ed and Weininskill, you're first.
Hi. Bob, the last time I talked to you, you mentioned how light coming in from great distances could get redshifted by the gravity it experienced, and I asked a question about how could they distinguish that from the idea that planets moving away would be redshifted, and you said they figured that out. Can you explain how they figured that out?
Now, you're talking about planets. You said planets. You mean planets or stars?
I meant stars and galaxies, yeah.
Okay. So you're saying, what is the difference between the expansion of space and actual motion? Is that your question?
They were saying that, well, as galaxies move away from us, that we see them redshifted. But then I mentioned that if light was coming from very, very, very far away, as it experiences gravity as it comes in, you said it could get redshifted by that gravity.
Yes.
And I said, well, how do they know that it's really expanding then, or is it just not redshifted from the effects of gravity?
No, you're right. There could be an identical redshift caused by either a gravitational redshift or a change in velocity, a velocity redshift. Both of them would produce a redshift. For example, when we look at the light from a white dwarf star, which has a fantastically strong gravity, we see all its spectral lines shifted over to the red. And in that case, that's produced by a gravitational redshift. That is, think of it as each photon of light has to fight the warped space-time in its vicinity to get out of there. And as it escapes from the neighborhood, all the wavelengths get lengthened, which is what a redshift is, and so we see it as redder. But if there were no strong gravity, if it were a star that had a weak gravity but was heading away from us, we could see an identical redshift. So how do we distinguish one from the other is your question.
Curious.
And
yeah.
Then you need secondary bits of evidence. For example, in our galaxy, we can look at stars, note their spectral class. We know if they're binary systems, we know what the gravity is because from the period of the two stars, and we can tell whether it's motion or whether it's a gravitational redshift. But the two would have the identical effect.
Wow. Interesting. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it very much. Let's go to John in Canaan. John, you're on with Bob Berman.
Hi there, Bob. You there?
Yes.
You mentioned something in your introduction about this new theory involving dark matter, and I was curious about one point you mentioned having to do with the age of the universe. What are its implications for the age of the universe? Is it much older, much younger, or
the universe would be then much older than we think.
How much older?
Now, you know from past shows that there are intimations now that the universe is probably infinite. But the Big Bang was not an infinite time ago.
Right.
It was 13.7 billion years ago, we think. But that's based on modeling. That's not based on any really hard evidence. That's based on when did the light escape from a universe that used to be opaque and then suddenly became transparent to let light through, and that happened 13.7 billion years ago. But what if the period before that was billions of years long? And anyway, how do you get an infinite universe from a finite event like the Big Bang? We just shrug and we say, well, the Big Bang could have just been a local event, something in the observable universe. There are other Big Bangs that could have happened, but the overall larger universe is infinite. This new thing changes even that. Because if gravity is different than what we think, mm-hmm. we're basing the time of the Big Bang on the rate of expansion. We're tracing everything back. We're extrapolating in reverse and factoring in that the universe has changed its rate of expansion about when it was half the current age. And then we arrive at the figure that we've arrived at. But if gravity is different from the way we think, then it didn't take this long to get to the present point. It could have taken much, 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 much longer.
Wow.
I don't know if we're back to the steady state theory of Hoyle, but it does mean back to the drawing board so far as the age of things go.
So that is really very fascinating. And basically, the more we know, the less we know, I guess.
Ah, that's it.
But if you want to read more about the theory that you were describing, where would you go?
Look up Google Israeli physicist, because it was originally an Israeli theory, although others are on board now. And dark matter, does dark matter exist? I think that would do it. This would be my guess. That would probably take you to it.
Okay. John, we got to take a break, but thank you for the call. Bob Berman is our guest. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Back with more calls coming up. Vox Pop on WAMC. Astronomer Bob Berman is our guest. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Question came in. Not sure how this came in. It was either an email or via the social media. Patrick O'Fish asks you this, Bob. When we talk about redshift, how do we know dust and gas in the interstellar medium is not simply absorbing non-red wavelengths?
Ah, well, it's not just simply that the light is reddened, and dust does do that. In fact, when we look towards the center of the galaxy, everything is so reddened mostly by carbon particles that we don't even see the center of the galaxy. But if we have wavelengths that are, or equipment that can see through, for example, radio waves, then we can even map it out. So it's not just that things are redder than they should be, although they are. There's also a shift in the position of the spectral lines, and that you do not get from dust.
Mm.
That you get from an actual process that's lengthening the waves themselves and changing them from where they would be at a laboratory. You can heat up iron, and iron will have a signature glow. There'll be a line in the blue and a line in the green and specific emissions. But if the object that's emitting that is racing away from us, all those lines will still be precisely proportioned the way they were, but they will all be moved over to the red. The blue line will look green. The green line will look yellow. The yellow line will look red. They'll all be proportioned. We'll still see the same pattern. So we know it's iron that we're seeing, but it'll be in a different position. So that's not done by dust. Dust doesn't produce that. Only gravity or velocity or the expansion of space.
Did you happen to see, it was in the news last week or the week before, and I wish I had more details, but one of the telescopes up there optically was able to detect a planet nearby, relatively nearby, that is actually blue. And it was done by measuring the spectra of the star. And then as this thing went by, apparently, it was a little more blue. And they went around and around and double-checked this. So they finally figured the color of a nearby planet.
Right. I saw that. And it's fascinating. I mean, we have two very blue planets in our own solar system.
Yeah. This is a far different one, though.
Yeah.
Raining glass, I believe, was the description I saw.
Yeah. Really weird stuff. I'd also like to comment, the very first caller had a fascinating question about gravitational redshift versus caused by velocity. And this was a big question by Halton Arp some 25 or 30 years ago, where he was questioning all the redshifts that we're seeing and the distances and the ages of things based on a particular cluster of galaxies called Stefan's Quintet, where one seemed to have a discordant or disparate redshift from all the others, even though they seem to be linked. And he was suggesting this was caused by something other than the distance, which comes from our extrapolating of the velocity. He was saying that gravitational or other things are causing it, but that's since been solved. So I just wanted to tell that first caller that it's a valid issue. It's a good issue of what causes the redshift we see, and it has lots of implications.
Let's go to Peter in Albany. Peter, you're on with Bob Berman.
Yes, thank you. My question has to do with this new theory of gravitation that you've been talking about, and how would that alternative theory that the gravity might be stronger or weaker, not inverse square over great distances, how would that theory affect the observed gravitational redshift? Because if the gravity, gravity does affect redshift, and so the conclusions would seem to be, based on redshifts, would seem to be different if gravity doesn't work the way we think it does.
Gravity on redshift and velocity on redshift, of course, are two separate factors that change what the redshift would be.
I'm not raising the issue about velocity.
Right, but what velocity is important, because if the gravity is different from the way we think it is and it has a different effect, then the speeds that we observe, they may be valid speeds, but they indicate different distances than what we think, because the gravity that's pulling on objects is producing a different effect than what we seem to be seeing. And again, I'm not saying that hey, this is the new way it is. This is just an interesting
idea. No, I know. It's all speculative.
Yeah, and it's so speculative that I'd also like to add that, especially in recent shows, we've had a lot of callers and, being honest about cosmology, as Ray just said earlier on, you come to the conclusion that we're really like toddlers. We're in our infancy. We really don't know the basic questions that kids ask. Kids want to know, what is this universe? What's it made of? Well, we really don't know what 96% of the universe is made of. Was it ever born? We don't know that, whether it's eternal or whether it's born. What will happen in the future? We don't know what's going to happen. Not that many cosmologists will admit this on TV shows, but they sure admit this to each other. We're really, really in our infancy, and there's so much we don't know when it comes to the big questions, but I don't want to leave the impression that this is a depressing, because I've seen in lecture audiences the people just kind of look blankly at the speaker. Me in
you
that
mean like
case.
I do most of the time. and
it seems like, whoa, it's like they're almost like, what do you do with that? Are you depressed? So I do want to add that cosmology, the questions about the universe as a whole, are one thing, but versus the rest of astronomy, for example, studying the nature of the stars and planetary geology, there's so much more that we're constantly learning about, and it's growing all the time. Mm. We know what makes the stars shine, for sure. Not it's not a theory, because we know the neutrino production is exactly what it should be, the proton-proton cycle that fuels the sun. So I don't want to leave a depressing, downbeat impression that astronomers are all like grasping around, don't know what they're talking about. It's really the field of cosmology, one of the branches of astronomy, that's where we now know that we know less than we thought we did back in 1998, when a lot of this crazy stuff began.
Okay, well, and I guess if the universe is infinite, then we'll always be in our infancy.
Good.
All right, let's go to Carl in Palatine. Carl, you're on.
Hi, I really appreciated that last caller. As one of the kids who continues to have a question from grade school, no, I'm serious. I admit to it. If space is primarily a vacuum, and we send up, or somebody sends up a rocket ship, what in the world is the exhaust from the rocket ship pushing against in order to power it forward? And then secondly, from an article I remember Bob Berman having written, it was before 2000, I was sitting in a dentist office, and it struck me, proton-powered rocket ships. Can you explain this in relation to typical liquid rockets or whatever?
Okay, great. All right, well, go ahead, Bob.
Okay, I'm just scribbling down so I don't forget your two-part or three-part.
I have two more, by the way.
All right, well, hey, listen, take a number, you know?
Okay, first thing about what is the exhaust pushing against, you're not alone with that, because the New York Times wrote, this is a fabulous goof-up by the New York Times in the 1920s, I think it was, when they were talking about Robert Goddard, you know, the American
pioneer the rocket
of rocketry,
yeah.
And he was talking about a rocket going into space, and the New York Times said, of course rockets can't go into space. Once they leave the atmosphere, the exhaust won't be pushing against anything. Anyone who's had any high school basic science knows that. Somebody should explain to Dr. Goddard the basics of physics. And of course, later on, decades later, actually, the New York Times had to apologize for their own ignorance. And that is that Newton's law, the equal and opposite business, does not require that the exhaust from a rocket push against anything. That the equal and opposite effect simply means that when you have some motion in one direction, there is an equal and opposite effect from the other. Nothing is really pushing against anything. And we see this, for example, if we fired a bullet from a gun, there's a recoil from the gun going in the opposite direction. That's equal to, if you take into consideration that the gun is heavier than the bullet, if you calculate their masses, the gun is going backwards in this, to the same degree when you consider speed and mass both as the bullet is going forward. And even if you were on the moon or in space, you'd still get that recoil. You don't need either the gun or the bullet to either of them to be pushing against anything.
Okay.
This is just a basic of physics. It's equal and opposite. When you push against a stalled car and try to push it down the road, what you feel against your hand, the car, you're moving the car forward, but you're feeling a force against your hand equal, pushing you back, that's equal to what you're pushing forward. You can actually experience that. And if you jump up on Earth, you're pushing the Earth in the opposite direction, of course, because you weigh so much less than the Earth. The Earth essentially doesn't budge, but nonetheless, the effect is there. Okay, your second question was the propulsion. And some years ago, the first visit to a comet, in fact, was done by a rocket that used ion propulsion. That means instead of having a relatively short burst, minutes, of high-speed chemical propulsion, either in the case of the space shuttle, we use hydrogen and oxygen, liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, producing a huge amount of energy, or in the case of our Saturn V rocket, we had ordinary kerosene. Can you believe that?
Kerosene,
we went to the
really?
Moon with kerosene, burning stinky ordinary kerosene that you'd use on a camping trip mixed with liquid oxygen. That's what took us to the moon.
Wow.
But the high-speed gases that would come out the back, yes, they produce that equal and opposite effect. But instead of that, lasting only for a few minutes and producing a lot of forward motion, we've already had ion propulsion, which means pieces of atoms. And the caller just mentioned protons. So you just send atom fragments out at tremendously high speeds, and there are mechanisms by which you can have this happen, not just for minutes or hours, but for days and days. You have this much smaller mass of material going out, but you have it steadily continuing, and so there's a slow but steady acceleration until the rocket reaches a speed that's useful.
Okay, Carl, thanks a lot. Let's go to Roscoe in Kingston. You're on.
Hi, I have a question about the tides. The question is concerning the tidal bulge opposite the moon.
Right.
I've seen two explanations. One is that it's centrifugal because the barycenter of the Earth and the moon is actually within the Earth. The other explanation is no, when you draw the vectors, you get a bulge on the other side, but when I draw the vectors, I get a flattening on the opposite side, but obviously that's not reality. So I'm hoping you can break the tie.
Okay, thank you, thank you. And what the just to explain to our listeners what we're talking about is that as Earth rotates under the moon, even though the moon weighs 81 times less than the Earth does, there is a bulge that on average is 3 feet tall in the oceans, and an 8-inch bulge in the solid Earth. As the Earth goes spins around under the moon. In actuality, we spin a little bit too fast, so the bulge advances a little bit. The caller probably doesn't know this, is a kind of a cool fact. So the bulge is actually a little bit ahead of the exact Earth-moon line.
The tide is 25 hours.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And but there's also a bulge on the far side, on the opposite side, facing away from it. Now, those who live by the sea experience this because we get a high tide, and it's not 24 hours, that is one Earth rotation, until you get the next high tide, but roughly 12 hours, mm-hmm. 12 and a half hours. So that means there's a bulge on the opposite side away from the moon. And that's the one that puzzles people, and that's the one the caller is talking about. So why is this happening? And there, the two common explanations are that if you pull on one side of Earth, you're pulling on, and these are both ways of visualizing it. The actual physics, the mathematics is just as it is. These are actual ways of visualizing what's happening, because the truth is that the torque, the caller may enjoy this too, is a horizontal thing, not a vertical factor at all. There's a horizontal motion of the sea that adds on to each other, so that the maximum pull is not under the moon, but the positions of Earth that are right angles to it, the places where the moon is rising and falling. That's what's really moving and being additive to pull to create this bulge, which is, by the way, averages 5 feet by the coast, simply because when the oceans reach the coast, there's an exacerbating effect of the shallowing of the water at that point. But in the open sea, it averages 3 feet. So it's, you can picture it as being that the moon is pulling on the oceans that are closest to it more than it's pulling on the Earth, and pulling more on the Earth than the oceans on the far side, sort of leaving it behind. And if you actually work out the math, even though gravity falls off inversely with the square of the distance, the tidal effect varies with the cube of the distance. So distance to the source, in this case the moon we're talking about, varies with the cube of distance. So because Earth's 7,926-mile diameter is actually a few percent of the moon's very close distance of 238,000 center-to-center distance, there is a significant difference between the oceans on the near side, the center of Earth, and the oceans on the far side, and this produces this different effect from the front to the back. Okay, that's explanation one. Explanation two, and the caller correctly used the word barycenter, is that the moon doesn't go around the center of Earth. It goes around where it balances out with the Earth. If you had a seesaw, you'd see that a place 1,000 miles below Earth's surface in the direction of the moon is where the rest of the Earth plus the distance to the moon and the moon would balance on a seesaw. So the whole shebang goes around a spot under the surface, but not at Earth's center. The moon goes around that spot, but the Earth, too, wobbles once every month, or once every 27.32166 days, reliably around this spot that's not at the center of Earth, but 1,000 miles below the surface. So if you think of centrifugal force like a carnival ride, there's the moon going around that center, but the part farthest away from it, which is on the farthest part of the Earth away from the moon, is thrown off like a carnival ride, and so the oceans rise up on that side. And that accounts for, you can think of either way equally as accounting for those opposite the moon tides.
Does that account for plate tectonics as well?
No.
Not at all.
No, plate tectonics is just the ocean, the rift that we're getting in the bottom of the Atlantic floor. It's mostly from the Atlantic fissure that's letting stuff out and spreading apart the crust at that point.
So the movement of the crust has nothing to do with the seesaw point being 1,000 miles below the surface.
Right.
Because I would think that
That's it. That's just the hot earth and where stuff from down below is coming out.
All right. Hey, Roscoe, thanks a lot for the call. Bob Berman is our guest. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Astronomy, yes, your calls and more coming up. 1-800-348-2551. Back in a flash.
Support for WAMC comes from the Pirates Lakeside Grill at Nassau Lake with local organic grass-fed beef burgers, pastured pork hot dogs, worst plate, and featuring the hot fudge sundae. Open Thursday through Sunday, noon to 8 p.m. PiratesLakesideGrill.com. Earth Angels Veterinary Hospital, Wappingers Falls, an integrated facility that combines conventional and holistic medicine for a 360-degree approach to veterinary care. EarthAngelsVet.com. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. AshfieldStone.com. Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York. Identity Eyewear, it's what sets you apart. EYEDENTITY Eyewear.net. Chesterwood, Stockbridge, Massachusetts, the summer home and studio of Daniel Chester French, sculptor of Abraham Lincoln for the Lincoln Memorial, chesterwood.org. And Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival, presenting Ballet BC, contemporary ballet from British Columbia, bringing its diverse repertoire to the Berkshires through July 21st. Jacobspillow.org for tickets.
One 800 348 2551 is our number on Vox Pop. Astronomer Bob Berman is our guest. We have an open line or two here. 800-348-2551. You can also post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. Or you can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can tweet your questions at WAMC Vox Pop or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. The best way to do it is just to give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. By the way, I forgot to mention that Bob's most recent book is The Sun's Heartbeat, which is out in paperback. It's a terrific read, which even I can understand. That means you can understand it at home, and it's a lot of fun to read. Now, you have done some stuff in your magazine, essentially.
Astronomy magazine, yes.
About the history of the solar system.
Yeah, interestingly enough, on my page this month, in the July issue, and I just was waiting in a doctor's office the other day, opening up the National Geographic, and darn it if they didn't have in the current issue some of the same stuff. And, how can
Did they steal it?
No. All right. They couldn't have. But it's great. Why are we all thinking of this stuff at the same time? So I guess that means it's worth bringing up that the solar system's history is different from the way we studied it in school, where we thought pretty much the planets were all born 4.5 billion years ago, pretty much born where they are now.
Yeah.
And the solar system has lived in stability since then. Well, we no longer believe that. And it's fascinating. And I'll bring up two crazy things that are happening in the solar system. One, the relationship between Pluto and Neptune is that Neptune could not have forever been where it is now. It had to have arrived at a finite point in the past,
mm-hmm.
because it has this crazy locked-in relationship with Pluto. It's a crazy orbit where Neptune goes around the sun three times in exactly the same time that Pluto goes around twice. And they go around in such a way that when they are closest, they are separated the opposite way because Pluto's orbit is slanted, so that they never meet. But Pluto, you would think that, well, what's the closest planet that Pluto can come to? It must be Neptune, the planet inside of it. No, Pluto gets closer to Uranus.
Really?
Than it can ever come to Neptune. Even though Neptune, on paper, if you look at it straight down in a drawing with all the circles going around the sun, looks like that's the closest planet. And this strange kind of planetary relationship also shows itself with Mercury, Venus, and Earth around the sun, that we now know that because of Jupiter's pulling on Mercury, every time Mercury goes around the sun once and is closest to Jupiter, Jupiter gives it a little tug. And over time periods of, it could be as little as a billion years from now, Mercury's orbit will change shape, and become wildly distended and maybe even extend all the way out to poor Venus's orbit. Because Venus has the most well-behaved orbit of all. It's the roundest orbit, and it's minding its own business. But Mercury may move so far out that it'll collide. There's a 1 in 100 chance that it'll collide with Venus and destroy both of them.
Now, could this have happened in the distant past in the solar system?
Well, it could have been maybe why something smashed into us, something the size of Mars smashed into us early in the solar system's history and created our moon. There's even a 1 in 500 chance that Mercury could go far enough out to destroy Earth.
Wow.
Or could at least knock Venus from its orbit so it could destroy Earth. So all this nice stability that we think we had in the solar system is not there.
Fascinating. So it could end up being like a billiard game.
Yeah.
Just, wow. Let's go to the phones. Jean in Catskill is on. Hi, Jean.
Hi. Hi, Ray. It's nice to think of a Bob and Ray show renewed.
Ah, yes. Not quite as funny, yes.
Yes, I was wanting to ask Mr. Berman what his feeling is about infinity, if he ever tries to contemplate it, because I understand several people have gone quite mad trying to figure it out, and I won't even give it a thought, but I'll hang up and listen to his answer.
Well, Gene, I think you know he's already quite insane.
Oh, that's all right, then. Join the club.
Okay, fair enough. All right, well, Bob, what do you think? Thanks, Gene.
Well, there's some things you can't picture, and of course, infinity is one of them, and that's why some people are troubled with it. But beyond that, you can't even prove infinity. There's no way to prove that the universe is infinite in size or contains infinite material. How would you? You can prove that the universe is finite, but you can't prove the opposite. So we think it's infinite, mostly based on evidence since 1998, like baryon acoustic oscillations and the Hubble constant, but mostly the flat topology of space. We see light coming from distant parts of the universe, and it travels in a straight line, showing it's not curved as it gets here, even from the farthest places. And if the universe has no curve to it, then it can't have any size that we know of. It either has to, at minimum, be far larger than we ever thought, or infinite. And a lot of cosmologists that I've spoken to think that infinite makes the most sense. Perhaps aesthetically, it makes the most sense also. Our caller asks if we can picture it. No, you can't picture infinity. You can't picture an infinite number of galaxies, which is what an infinite universe would suggest, since if the universe is homogeneous per cubic light year, there's a certain number of stars everywhere, then it would be infinite numbers of stars and galaxies. You can't picture that either. But on the other hand, you couldn't picture the previous models, which were a universe that was born at a finite time and what preceded that.
Right.
That wasn't visualizable either. People have trouble with that, but it seems to be that the human brain logic, math, physics system is based on parts and how they relate to each other and mathematics and all sorts of things that are perhaps not amenable to these bigger questions. Certainly, we can picture things we've experienced, but just as a person blind from birth, cannot picture the color blue, we can't picture anything that we've not experienced, and infinity is one of them. Lies outside what symbolic reason and thoughts do.
1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Bob Berman is our guest. 800-348-2551. So you mentioned in your answer to Gene that scientists believe that the universe is now, it's flat. So it used to be they thought it was a donut or whatever. Now it is flat.
Well, we don't mean flat in two-dimensional flat like a piece of paper. It just means that a light ray from a very, very distant galaxy, instead of traveling on a curved path to get here, which would indicate that all the material, the sum total of everything between us and it, is causing a curvature.
So there's a dimension to it.
Yes, yes. But we don't see that. A study that was released last year from the University of California at Berkeley of 800,000 galaxies, this was the largest ever survey, showed a completely flat topology, and that goes out farther than we've ever looked before. So what do we know for sure? For sure, the universe is far larger than the observable universe. When people say, oh, yeah, it's 13.7 billion years. Well, it's at even the potentially observable thing, even no matter how much time we have, galaxies that we know of have to be at least 42 billion light years away. But even that's just a drop in the bucket. It's got to be far larger than that at minimum, and possibly, and maybe we could even say probably infinite.
Okay, let's go to Tom in Woodbury. Tom, you're on.
Good afternoon. I hope, I pray this question doesn't appear too dumb. But since a child, when they were going through all that A testing and the H-bomb, and it's always struck me, has anyone ever thought of when you locate that much force in one place, say like the Nevada test flats, thousands of A-bombs, has that ever affected like the rotation of the Earth or where we're going gravity-wise or anything
no,
like that?
No, it's still too small when you look at the weight of the Earth, which is about 4 followed by 27 zeros in grams. This is just too small a torque. Even when we have a major earthquake, like what happened in Japan, which is far more powerful than any hydrogen bomb we've ever blasted, even that changed the rotation of the Earth by just a fraction of a second.
Oh, great.
It did have an effect. It did slightly shift the Earth's spin, but very slightly. No, the atom bombs can't do that for all the other mischief that it might do. And so far as dumb questions, don't worry about asking a dumb question. I used to say that there are no dumb questions in astronomy, but I realized that the more honest answers that you cannot top the questions that we've had in the past.
Great.
In terms of dumbness. So don't be afraid of even getting close to that.
All right, Tom.
Thank you. It really puts my mind at rest.
Yeah.
You know, in this very seat, in July of 1994, we had an upcoming solar eclipse here in Albany. It was going to be an annular eclipse, a rare one, and we were warning people not to stare at the sun without using welding goggles. And a woman called the station and said, if the eclipse is so dangerous, why are they having it?
Ah, well, I mean, yeah, can't call the whole thing off.
Right, exactly.
That's a great point.
It's hard to top these.
Timothy in Gilderland, you're on. Timothy.
Hi, good afternoon.
Sure.
I'm really enjoying the program, but I have a question based on the Jupiter influencing Mercury conversation of a few minutes ago.
Okay.
And what I would like to know is if we're going to allow the model that Jupiter is going to influence Mercury out of its orbit, why wouldn't we believe as well that it's going to influence Venus and Earth from theirs? Although they're not as elliptical, I suppose, in their orbital path, but why wouldn't they also be affected?
Well, they are affected to some degree because Jupiter really rules the solar system. As you might know, if you take all the other planets and combine them and double them, you don't have the mass of Jupiter alone. So Jupiter is really calls the shots in the solar system. But you said so just a moment ago. Mercury's orbit is by far the most eccentric of all the planets. It's got an orbital eccentricity of 0.20. Nothing comes close to that. And so because of that, it goes outward and then goes inward, and it can, when Jupiter is aligned just right, it's in a position to change the shape of the orbit more than it does for the other planets. Also, Mercury is a low-mass planet. It's has less mass than either Earth or Venus, and so has more an effect on it. So because of that, and even this is a tiny, tiny little nudge. And that's why we're talking about events that will be a billion or more years in the future. Mm. And we're still not sure because there's other things. Saturn has something to say about it also. And there's a chance that the Mercury eccentricity, which goes from more eccentric to more circular and back again, will reach a far point and then return to more circular. It's too complex to even know for sure if it will ever get so eccentric that it can actually reach the orbit of Venus and do this trouble. In fact, it's considered only 1 chance in 100 that it'll actually hit Venus. So
it's just something that's a pretty low chance. I mean, 1 in 100 in astronomical terms, that's a pretty good shot.
It is a very good shot. It's a fascinating topic to consider.
Timothy, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. James in Monroe. James, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering, I always had questions about stuff, and since we're made of stardust, energy, and matter, could the universe be a living thing?
Well, you know, that's not as far-fetched or not amenable to science as some might think. Certainly, Dr. Robert Lanza and I co-wrote a book called Biocentrism a few years ago. It's still in print. In fact, it's selling rather well, in which the central thesis is that consciousness, or us as living creatures, and the universe are correlative, that the universe isn't a dumb thing that created life, but it's the other way around, if anything, that life and the universe absolutely are linked. And there's a lot of support for that. John Wheeler, we're talking about Nobel-level physicists, said that no object really exists unless it's observed. Quantum mechanics is showing us more and more that the observations determine whether an electron just exists, not only in electrons, but entire atoms exist as little blurry probabilistic things, or are actual objects in actual locations. And so if observation changes the universe, and if everything we see occurs strictly inside our skulls, which is what Dr. Roy Bishop of the Canadian Astronomical Society keeps writing about. Mm-hmm. He says that everything, that the entire universe exists entirely in our skulls. There's no color, there's no light, that the two go together. It sounds crazy, I'll admit that. The universe is inside our skulls, and our skulls obviously are inside the universe. How can both be true? How do you picture that? You can't picture that, just like you couldn't picture infinity. But it does come down to what this caller is saying, that the universe could be a living, essentially a living and perhaps eternal organism.
Wow. Okay. Well, we waited to the end of the show to blow my mind, but let's go to David on the Mass Pike. David, you're on.
Oh, hello. Let's turn off the radio.
Very quickly, yeah, Dave. We only got about a minute, okay?
Okay, here it is. I just wanted to talk about my concept of infinity. We're driving down the Mass Pike, and here's what I think infinity is in the universe. That what's happening here at this moment with the trucks going by is happening somewhere else in the universe. Everything, and moment to moment, this is infinity. It's happening in the universe. The universe is so vast that it's something that it's been what we're seeing right now at this moment is actually happening somewhere else in the universe.
Although you could also argue that a universe that's infinite could have infinite variety too. I'm not sure which way it goes. I'm not even disputing you. Once you get to
these,
yeah.
Yes. The reason I think I like infinite variety, absolutely. The other way, I hear you. But because we look into the universe and don't we see all the same? Don't we see the same elements? Don't we see the same stuff that makes the Earth?
Well, we've got the 92 elements, stable elements are everywhere, but that's only 4% of the universe. We don't know what all the rest of the stuff is. And besides, even given 92 elements, look at the variety we have. Look at the variety you just have if you just have carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, throw in a few more like phosphorus, and you have every type of crazy living being you can. Throw in nitrogen, and you're now have more possibilities than we could even think of. So 92
yes.
is even more than
yeah.
you need.
All right. Well, David, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We're going to have to shut the lava lamp down for another program. But thank you very much. And, you know, it's a shame these people don't call earlier, that we would have a truly, truly crazy hour. But we got into the esoteric stuff.
We should light incense and have lava lamps.
We should. It'll set off the smoke detectors. Yeah. But, you know, damn it, it'll be worth it. Bob Berman is our guest. We're out of time. Thanks to everybody who called in. Sorry if you didn't make it through.